This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week it's all about the rain, rain, rain.
Did we mention the rain? You know us. You know us well. We never, ever complain. Resolutely cheerful. That's what we are. Oh, the rain. Oh, the rain. It's soggy. Distinctly soggy. I'm Mark Stephen, standing, well, nowhere near me, to be honest, here at Beechgrove Car Park in Aberdeen. Rachel Stewart, cowering under the portico.
Yeah, trying to find some kind of shelter. You know, it's been like four seasons in a day recently.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was driving from Aberdeen north towards Moray, mm-hmm. and suddenly, at about 9 o'clock in the morning, it was a winter wonderland.
Uh-huh.
Later in the afternoon, there was a wee hint of sunshine in the sky mm-hmm. in Moray. And then at night, again, heavy rain. And I see today, it's gusty winds.
The winds dispatched. As you said that, my script nearly shot out my hands.
Just for dramatic effect.
Yeah, I say script. Papier-mâché ball is probably closer to the truth.
I can't believe this is the first show in April. First show in April, and it's definitely not feeling very spring-like.
No,
April showers.
Well, this showers? Sorry, I didn't mean to shout. Ron's ears are bleeding now. Sorry about that, Ron.
Let us know if this will impact your plans for the weekend.
Not if you have a
canoe. Indoors. Outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is our email address. Or you can text us, 80295. Or you can give us a ring, 0808592950. Apparently this is Storm Karen, is it? Someone like that.
I agree with that neighbour of mine who said the weather has got considerably worse since they started naming storms.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it was just a coarse day.
We also have a mystery sound for you this morning, and it's quite exciting because it's come from a listener. Let's have a listen.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
The listener thinks it might be too easy, but we are not convinced.
No.
Yeah. Get in touch then. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or ring us 0808592950.
Hear running water in the background. So that's a bit of a clue, I suppose, but more than that, don't know.
That's the water running down the back of my neck.
I would have expected it to be louder than that. Last week in the programme, Alistair and Elgin, one of our regulars, got in touch asking, and this is the question on everyone's lips at the moment, how do you dissuade a badger from using your garden as a toilet? Well, unsurprisingly, we'd no idea. So we decided to ask someone who does. Eddie Palmer is the chair of a charity called Scottish Badgers, and he started by telling me what attracts badgers to our gardens in the first place.
Well, they're coming in either for shelter or for food, two very definite things. And things like decking in gardens, sheds, they will go under. Not all the time, but they will some of the time. And for food, they're after whatever's under the lawn. Their main diet is invertebrates and earthworms, that's what they're after. But also they like bulbs as well. So they make merry on people's bulbs if they find them. And you're obviously going to ask, you know, how to keep them out of a garden. And often people might have some sort of fencing and never think about badgers getting in. I mean, they'll get in if they possibly can, if they really want to feed on something. And good fencing is the main way of keeping them out. And that could be quite simple, could work.
When you're talking about fencing, something like chicken wire, but I'm assuming here you would have to bury it somehow.
Yeah, at least a foot down, have to go in, and preferably with a return, and be a pretty strong one. I've got to say, if it's a chain link fence, they'll just come over it though.
Really? They'll climb it?
I've seen badgers escape from a setup that a vet in England had, actually, where he was keeping them with a very high chain link fence, which I think about 12 feet or something like that. And the badgers have pretty much straight over it and out. You know, I've never seen anything like it.
I've seen badgers live, but I've seen an awful lot of them by the side of the road. I have a tendency, if I find something killed by the side of the road, I'll move it in. I don't like things getting flattened on the road. Mm. What always astonishes me about badgers is they feel like solid muscle. I mean, they're not a huge animal, but really, really strong.
Yes, they are, our fourth largest mammal now in Britain, and one that's been here a very long time. They're probably, going back in history, one of the original mammals here. So, you know, we're talking about tens of thousands of years, actually, they go back.
And beautifully adapted to dig, too. I mean, those claws.
Yes. They're absolute burrowing creatures. They hide away from us by digging sets of the underground. Vast proportion of the population never seen a badger. Anyway, we keep being told that. And the usual thing where people's interest comes up is in spring. And because the cubs are born about February the 1st and the mother's looking after them, last year's cubs, the yearlings, are encouraged to leave, we think, or it's a natural thing and they start wandering, and they're naive, so that's why they get killed on the road in large numbers.
I like that phrase, encouraged to leave, kicked out
maybe. Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, there's so much about badger family life we don't know yet. You know, we don't know actually what goes on underground, but you know, they certainly, for example, seem to have babysitters, you know, like aunties looking after cubs at times. Sometimes the sow will leave the main set and go to a periphery set to have the cubs to get some peace and quiet, we think. I've seen several examples of that because we pick that up on trail cameras nowadays, pick up a lot of behaviour of them.
How would you know the difference between, say, very large, you know, rabbit warren and a badger set?
Usually you have to have your eye in on various signs because we're very careful about deciding that a set is a set. It's the size of the holes and the amount of what they dig out. Nothing else digs as much as that. No other mammal or animal digs out such large stones out of the ground. The holes are D-shaped, they're badger-shaped for them to go in and out.
So basically like a railway tunnel, essentially.
Yeah, and it will have to continue, you know, in to the ground for quite a distance to ensure that.
Going back to this business of trying to keep badgers out of the ground, you can put up fencing, etc. Would you be happy? Would you countenance electric fencing, for example?
Well, some people do use electric fences. I mean, people with allotments, for example, sometimes they have a collective need to keep their vegetables from being eaten all the time, so they use electric fencing. So that actually is a humane possibility, yeah.
Alistair from Elgin asked the question, how do I keep badgers out of my garden? There was a kind of a, you know, last minute, too late for us to actually broadcast, flush of responses, umpteen of which contained the suggestion that they don't like the smell of human urine. So pee in your garden, any human. You're laughing at that.
Yeah, we've heard that, but really don't know about that. I mean, people can try, you know, all sorts of things. Maybe. The other thing is that bird feeding, again, especially in the spring, attracts them in. So lots of things drop from bird feeders. So I've seen plenty of gardens where people just say, oh, you know, they come in here and they'll eat here and then they go away again. That's more normal than them just moving in. Yeah.
So they're coming into the garden for invertebrates. They like the shelter underneath the deckings and sheds and things like that. They'll dig up bulbs. They'll basically burrow through your lawn and create scrapes and things like that. With all of that, you know, there are going to be gardeners listening to this thinking, how terrible, how awful. Do you, given your position, understand why anyone would want to keep badgers out of the garden?
Would want to keep them out. I can guess if they're a gardener that they're very proud of, I understand that. But badgers are part of the landscape, they're here, you know, they're part of what we've got. So People should be very tolerant of them. And legally, you have to be careful about how much you dissuade badgers. You're not supposed to harm them in any way. If they move in near permanently, that is an issue. And some people have paid for badger consultants, which there are, and professional ecologists, to move them. But that's a long and expensive job, that is. Because for things like road and railways, we've got plenty of that going on. That's what's happening at the moment. They moved. So the Aberdeen Western Peripheral Road, quite a lot of badger sets were moved to the side for that. And it's a long business, that.
Do you get badgers in your garden?
No, we have badgers nearby. We would love for them to come into my garden. They could do what they like when they get in. And quite a few people, we have had instances where people have come to us, which they can, and been worried and a bit fussy, but they have been taught really to tolerate badgers. And I can think of a couple of villages in the borders actually where badgers are now living in gardens in the centre of villages, and everybody's happy with them because they like seeing them.
Eddie Palmer from Scottish Badgers there. We were having a conversation during that piece about what other species might come into your garden, how you might actually dissuade them from doing so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so things like moles, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I think gardeners wouldn't really want moles in their garden.
No.
Apparently they don't like strong-smelling stuff, so they don't like mint. So it might be an idea to plant mint, that kind of thing.
Stick polo mints down the holes, that annoys them.
Yeah. You've got a good one for deer.
Well, it wasn't really my suggestion. It was an old friend of mine, Willie Duncan, sadly no longer with us. But Willie suggested getting lion dung from the zoo, because obviously everyone's got a zoo nearby, and putting it into an old pair of tights and then hanging it in the trees. And apparently the deer don't like the smell of that.
Yeah, but your neighbours do either.
Well, the neighbours are neither here nor there. But he did make the point that you've got to keep it fresh.
Mm-hmm.
It goes off quite quickly.
Mm. It sounds quite intensive, this. I'm not sure. Not sure it's for me.
You would develop quite a good relationship with the zookeeper. Yes,
certainly would.
Turning up with your bucket every so often saying, hello.
If you've got interesting suggestions on this topic,
but only interesting ones. We're not interested in non-interesting suggestions.
Text us 80295 or email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Remember I said it was damp? Listen, I'm going to hold this right up to the microphone. That's the sound of a piece of paper being scrunched up.
Moving on. Right, the Killyhassie burial ground near Aberfeldy has a fascinating history.
Is that country and western song?
Does it? Is it?
I'm sure it is.
No.
It's Tallahassee Bridge, my mistake.
There we go. Overlooking the River Tay, this picturesque site holds just six graves, and five of them are covered over with recumbent flat slabs. For years, it was allowed to become neglected, but in the 1990s, the Bradalbin Heritage Society started to take an interest in it, and they discovered that it not only dates back hundreds of years, but it also has connections to King Robert the Bruce and the Wolf of Badenoch. Ian Stewart showed me round.
Killyhassie Estate was a large estate, and over the years it got sold off into different bits. And this particular area where the burial ground is actually no longer part of the estate, but it's not known who actually owns it.
Oh, so that's quite tricky in itself.
That's quite interesting, yes. Originally, there was a chapel or a church up on the hillside, and the Killyhassie name actually means the church of the steep face. So somewhere up above us, there would have been a church at one point, but it became dilapidated. But, I mean, the burial ground dates back to 1727, when the estate was owned by a Reverend Robert Stewart.
What do you know about him?
He is a direct descendant of King Robert the Bruce.
So this was clearly an influential family.
Yes. I mean, Robert Stewart was a direct descendant, as I say, of King Robert the Bruce via King Robert's daughter, Marjorie Bruce, who married Walter Stewart, who was a hereditary High Steward of Scotland. And Robert Stewart, the only son of those two, succeeded his uncle David II, King David II, and became Robert II, King of Scots, the first Stuart monarch and the ancestor of all the successors of the thrones of Scotland, England and the United Kingdom. So a very important royal line.
Is there actually much written on the stones that are on the ground? I know that you put a protective cover over them during the winter months, but is there anything much that you can detect from them when you can't see them?
The stones are wearing and wearing quite significantly now. And we have done some investigations to see whether there's something we can do to actually maintain or to sort of stabilise them. But the advice is generally from Historic Environment Scotland and others is you take records of the stones and you just let them do what they have to do in the climate. So we have got records of them. We have two information boards now that we've put in for this, and it actually gives you the information of who's on each burial.
How did it come to your attention and how has the society got involved with it?
The whole area here became very overgrown and wasn't being looked after because over the years when the estate was subdivided and sold off, I think this area got left out because it's the other side of the road from the main estate. And it therefore just fell into a situation where it actually wasn't really being owned or looked after by anybody. In sort of the late 1900s, 1997, I think, is when we first got involved. And members of our society in that time volunteered to try and sort of reinstate the whole area because it was very badly overgrown. So they did a lot of work at that point. We then raised some funds so that we could actually repair part of the surrounding external wall of the site, and it needed a lot of work and attention doing just to stabilise it again. And we've got some very nice sort of gates and things here which again also needed to have work done to them. So that started in around about the sort of beginning of 2000. We do sort of in the summertime we will strim paths around here and we'll sort of do what necessary work. We've had to do some more repair work to the outer wall, which was damaged from some of the gales, and we've done more work on the stones and things like that.
Do you find that you do get visitors who are interested in history?
We do. We don't know how many because there's no way we record them. I mean, sometimes we will meet people here or we will see people or we'll see a car parked. I mean, it's actually a difficult site to access because there's no car parking in the area. So you really just have to sort of pot your luck. And it's quite a busy road and there's a lot of farm traffic. So you just got to be careful with that. But yes, there are people who do come and visit it.
It's an utterly charming site, isn't it? It's just absolutely beautiful.
It's a lovely setting. And at the moment, we've got a little bit of flooding on the fields and we've got some grey-legged geese over there. But yes, it's a really nice setting. And we've done work on some of the trees here and raised the crowns and things just to make them a bit more accessible. And I've had to take away a couple of trees that had died. So we just sort of do what maintenance is necessary to just keep it accessible. And I think a lot of people won't know that this burial ground is here. But it is, it's got significance, and it's got significance from being related back to the Wolf of Badenoch, Alexander Stewart, and his estates and his influence in this area.
I wonder how many sites like this actually still exist in Scotland in this kind of condition as well, because I know that you're saying that the gravestones are obviously beginning to suffer due to the passage of time, but you can still read the writing on the big memorial stone on the wall there.
Yes, you can, and you can read it on the recumbent stones. There are others. In fact, there's another Stuart graveyard at Edradynet, but it's a different branch of the Stuarts. So there's quite a few of these at this sort of age, some well looked after, some not so much. But yes, throughout Scotland you will find small graveyards like this.
Giving a brilliant insight into our history.
Absolutely, absolutely. For all those who are keen on genealogy and looking back at their own family histories and trying to find ancestors and things, and it's very important to have these burial grounds, because quite often the burial people maybe not have been sort of notified anywhere else or identified or recorded anywhere else. So it's important to keep these graveyards and try and which is why it's important to actually record as much as you can at this stage before they actually just disappear.
Ian Stewart there, and if you're interested in the quite complex family history of this burial ground, then have a look at the Bridalban Heritage Society website. They've done a great job of unpicking it all, and there's a link to that on our site.
on BBC Sounds.
For the last 200 years, RNLI volunteers have been saving lives around Scotland's shores.
The guys in the crew, I'd like to think they're all very proud of me.
I got a hold of his hand, pulled him aboard the boat, and he's thanking me. I said, don't thank me yet.
Cat QB marks the organisation's bicentenary across two episodes.
You know, it really was a matter of life and death.
By hearing from its volunteers and those saved at sea.
The feeling was just unbelievable to know that someone's found us.
Stories from Scotland's seas, the RNLI at 200.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, she's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, the volunteers who are helping plant trees, and we hear from sheep farmer and Landward presenter Cammie Wilson about the impact this weather is having on lambing.
Of course, we've also got a mystery sound for you today from a listener. Let's have a listen.
Quite a difficult one, I think.
Mm-hmm, I think so, but yeah. We've got a right answer.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, well, Donnie reckons it's a dipper, as did Marion and Stirling. Is today's sound a dipper at the full fast-flowing burn? But Fred Gordon and Armadale and Ian and Till and Nessel and Richard Edwards from Ellen and Aberdeenshire all thought it was a kingfisher.
Mm-hmm. Geography girl in Torfinns also thought it's a dipper. She says it sounds appropriate for this morning. It can only get better. Graham in Rosemount as well, really appreciating the local forecast that we provide.
Indeed.
Says
it's an essential service.
Says it acts as an incentive or disincentive to get up. I know what he's thinking this morning. He says, I remember the farmers used to talk about the chuchu storm at this time of the year, apparently in reference to the curlew's nesting.
I'm not sure it was curlew so much as lapwings tuchets.
I think it was
lapwings.
Okay.
And it's they come in theoretically at the beginning of April and what have you. You start being much more visible then. So.
Well, anyway, he thinks it might be a dipper as well. Those guesses are wrong, but you've got lots of time to get in touch. Outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. Text 80295, or you can give us a ring. Give Sky a ring this morning on 0808 92 95 00.
We may have mentioned in passing the weather. It's not been great so far this spring. In fact, you'd be forgiven for thinking we're still in the depths of winter.
Yeah, I mentioned when I was driving up to Moray yesterday, I passed a lovely wintry, snowy scene. Mm-hmm. It wasn't lovely at all. I was sick to death of it. But it was the rain that got you, Mark, musing earlier this week. And, of course, he tried his hardest to take positives from the wet stuff.
I've got in my hand a piece of red sandstone. It's about the size of a saucer. And it dates from the time when Scotland actually sat south of the equator. The chunk I have probably came from a riverbank, and it's covered in dimples where rain fell on what was at the time soft sediment. The sun then baked that hard, and I'm guessing that a flash flood buried it in more sediment, which preserved the marks of these raindrops. So what I'm actually holding here is a record of a shower of rain. Big fat drops too, by the look of it. Which fell about 400 million years ago. I dug it out of the drawer to remind me that rain is nothing new. Now, it's been raining here for days. The ground is saturated. The sky is grey. I've got plenty of waterproof gear, but frankly, I'm fed up being soggy. Clearly, I'm not the only species feeling that way. I was out in the field last night picking up horse poo, there being no end to the fun in my life, when the rain stopped. Almost immediately, the skylarks in the field next to me climbed into the sky and started to sing. 5 minutes later, the rain came back on again, and just as quickly the skylarks dived for the deck, came back down into the grass, and never uttered another peep. Now, don't get me wrong. I know rain is good. Rain's necessary. It's what makes our country so green and fertile. Our rainfall is the envy of more arid parts of the world, like the Middle East, the Sahara, the home counties, but too much of it is a real pain in the backside. An old boss of mine, Bill Aikenhead, once came up with a really great phrase. He referred to the great grey chastity belt of the West Coast winter. Bill said that 40 years ago, but I think that nowadays you could equally apply it to the East Coast as well. Back in 2017, there was an interesting piece of research into whether or not rain is a contributing factor in clinical depression. The results were inconclusive, but certainly rain clouds mean less sunshine, which leads to less serotonin production. And if you think about it, most of us are much less inclined to go outside if it's pouring rain, so we are choosing, on the whole, to cut ourselves off from what little light there is. My advice, if you ask for it, which you didn't, is get a dog. Dogs don't care if it's raining or not, and you have to take them out, or they just sit there and look at you, reprovingly. Here is an oddball thought, though. If I asked you to draw a raindrop, what would you come up with? I'm guessing you'd probably sketch something that looks a bit like a teardrop, because that's how we've all been taught to represent rain. But in the real world, raindrops don't look like that. Very small raindrops, say about a millimetre in diameter, are round. But bigger ones, 2 millimetres, change shape as they fall. The resistance of the air beneath them flattens their bottoms, and you end up with something that looks like a tiny Tunnock's tea cake. As the drops get bigger, say 3 millimetres, their bottoms get pushed up even further and they develop a sort of dimple. So now we've moved from Tunnock's tea cakes to an upside-down Werther's original. At 4 mil, the raindrops dimple so much they're actually more like little parachutes. None of this is teardrop shaped. And while we're on the subject of rain, what is the best way to stay dry in a thunderplump? Now, you may have asked yourself this question as you stood there in the doorway, watching the rain hammering down and bouncing off the tarmac, thinking, would I be better to walk slowly to the car or to run? If I run, I spend less time in the rain, but I'm hitting the raindrops faster, so they'll wet me more. If I walk slowly, more raindrops will hit me, but at a lower velocity, so they may be less wetting. See, this is the kind of pointless internal monologue I revel in, and for all I know, you may be the same. If so, you'll be delighted to hear that a Professor Bocci looked at this very question in the Journal of European Physics and was able to state categorically, and I'm quoting directly here, that it depends. Brilliant. Tanto grazie, professore. Somebody probably got a PhD for that. We Scots have many fine words for weather-related phenomena. When Glasgow hosted COP26 a few years ago, the Washington Post, no less, printed a handy glossary of Scots words for attendees, including drich, schmurry, coors, drukit, and plutering. I was there at the event, and let me tell you this, boy, they probably ended up using all of them before lunchtime. Actually, Glasgow's not that bad. The wettest place in Scotland, according to the Met Office, is Glenetive, which, when they last checked, got 3,778 millimetres, or about 12.5 feet of rain in a year. That's wet, but it is just a wee damp patch compared with a town called Mosinram in India, which gets an astounding 11,971 millimetres of rainfall each year. Now, that is a stupid amount of rain. To cope with it, the locals have developed nifty, handcrafted bamboo rain shields called Knups, K-N-U-P-S. It's like a, I don't know, turtle shell, beetle carapace. Well, it's actually really quite like a coracle, except these things have got a pointy bow and a stern. You slip the bow over your head like a hood, and the rest of it covers you all the way down your back to just above knee level. I was looking at pictures of them, and I couldn't help thinking that if I had to live in an area that got 470 inches of rain in a year, I think I'd probably opt for an actual coracle just in case. By contrast, the driest place in Scotland, and I know you're itching to know this, is Dundee, City of Discovery, Ingen Pays, and Dry Drawers. And finally, I just want to mention the smell of rain. There's a particular smell you get when rain falls on ground after a long dry spell. The raindrops trap tiny air bubbles on the surface, which then effervesce, a bit like champagne. And when these bubbles burst, they broadcast in aerosol form the scent of the soil into the air. It's called petrichor. And I suspect it's probably going to be some time before we get to smell it here because the ground is sodden. But I am not going to let it depress me. Instead, I will share with you the wise words of the Sage of Tennessee, who said, "The way I see it is this. If you want the rainbow, you have to put up with the rain." See, that's real stoicism. Move over, Marcus Aurelius, and all hail Dolly Parton.
Oh, not often the Queen of Country gets a mention on Out of Doors, but it's nice when it happens.
Queen of Country? Dolly is the queen of everything.
Are you going to give us a blast?
I am not. I have too much respect for the woman. The woman is an absolute genius.
You're making
it. Was it Glastonbury? She said she turned up with like a plastic ukulele and pretended to play it, and the crowd went wild. You think, this is an entertainer to her toe tips.
What I took from that is that I can no longer draw the rein. You know, I draw the rein quite a lot from my toddler.
Really?
I can't do it now. I don't know how to draw a Werther's Original or a Tonic's Tea Cake. Too much.
Well, just do the lines.
Okay.
Just straight lines, you know, that's sleety rein.
You know,
and you get that, you get sensation of movement at the same time.
Mm-hmm. The smell of the rain's interesting as well, actually.
Petrichor, yeah.
You definitely get that smell on your clothes as well when you come in, when you've been outside in the rain.
That, as I said, it unfortunately only works in really dry, dusty conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a wee while before we actually manage to pick it up.
Yeah, no danger in this car park, that's for sure.
No, absolutely not. I was talking to a farmer just 2 days ago, you know, and he was saying, we were boning the fact that we've never seen anything like it. And there's rain coming out of the ground in places we've never seen raining coming out of the ground. But he says you get literally just a spit of rain, like a millimetre of rain or something like that, and it's back up over the top again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're getting puddles forming. He says, and that's never happened before.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, coming up, a new outdoor learning hub, which is aimed at sort of helping teachers learn how to use the outdoors by means of sort of communication and as a resource. And we chat to sheep farmer and presenter Cammy Wilson about this year's lambing season so far.
Yeah, which is wet. Definitely wet, wet, wet.
Wet.
We also have a mystery sound for you. Mm-hmm. One or two people getting it right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alistair
Taylor says, good morning. Today's mystery sound is a dipper in my estimation. I'm listening to the programme on board a ship working just off the Norwegian coast north of Bergen. Storm Kathleen, I think we said something else earlier. We said Storm Kathleen, that Storm Kathleen has still to reach this side of the North Sea. And apparently, Alistair, you got it right on your second guess.
Do you know that dippers have got a third eyelid so they can see underwater?
Have they?
Yeah, comes up. Called a nictitating membrane.
Oh, interesting fact.
Full of useless rubbish, me.
Have you got any other guesses?
No, not guesses, but comments about badgers.
Okay.
Jeff Jenkins says, we have badgers that visit our garden here in Gatehouse, a fleet on a regular basis. They have removed a few wasps' nests in the last couple of years, which is useful. And Alistair Nelgett, who kicked the whole badger thing off, says, good morning. Birdsong, not my area of expertise. I'm more of a rusty wheelbarrow person, so nowhere near. Many thanks for the advice, Ray, dissuading badgers from our garden. I'll revisit fencing where I think the point of entry is and see if that helps. I think you need to might do it the whole way around, Alistair. He goes on. I had read that male urine would give the impression of an alpha male, and I did spray from a carefully marked bottle, and it made no difference. Bit of a blow for the ego, he says. Keep up the good work.
Richard and Mandy in Devon are also on that theme. They say, we think ground coffee can be quite a good deterrent for some animals, including next door's cat. They've had a go at the mystery guess as well. They think it's a dipper.
Mm.
Good guesses.
I've heard of coffee grounds being used for things like slugs. They don't crossing coffee grounds.
Yeah, yeah. Keep your guesses coming and all your other interesting comments as well. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address. Text 80295 or you can give us a ring on 0808 92950.
It's gone off.
It has.
Don't see it.
Yeah.
Don't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what we're talking about.
Yeah. It's not doing it anymore.
Nope. No. A Scotland-wide test of the nation's rivers for microplastics, pharmaceuticals and various other chemicals, actually, is underway now. The study has started in the northeast, with sampling being carried out on two rivers, the Dee and the Ugee, and of course that takes in both rural and urban areas. I met Dr. Jessica Gomez-Bandaris on the riverbank near Peterhead to find out how they take the samples and, I suppose, what they're actually looking for.
So we actually have three different ways of taking a sample, but
Today I'm going to take a grab sample, which is where we take a 2.5 litre glass bottle and we put it into the river and we take a river water sample. It's as easy as that.
Even I could manage that. I'll follow you down.
Okie dokie. Try not to slip on the grass. It's been a bit rainy, hasn't it? Right. Whoop. Okie dokie. So I just go a little bit into the river. It's actually quite shallow. And then we give the bottle a little rinse out first of all, so it kind of just coats it in the river water, let's say. And then we go back in, we just put it under, let it do its thing and fill it up. You can hear the bubbles. There we go. And that's us collected what is our grab sample. So we've got 2.5 litres to take back to the lab. So we collect them once a month, a monthly grab sample from each of our 10 sites. But we've also got our automatic sampler, which is actually set up here.
Ah, so that looks like a big barrel. How does that work?
Yeah, so inside the barrel are glass bottles, and then you can see this pipe that's running down into the river. So this is programmed to take a sample every hour for 24 hours, and we do it over a two-week period. And we only do it twice a year to account for specific scenarios throughout the year. So if it's a high flow situation, say it's been very rainy, the river is very high, then we'll be like, okay, we need to go out now and do the intensive sampling. Or if it's a low flow situation, say in summertime, where the river is looking a bit dry, it's looking a bit lower, then we'll also do a 14-day intensive automatic sampling as well to account for those specific scenarios, which are a bit different.
Now, you're doing this to build up a picture of what's in Scotland's rivers, and you're looking specifically at pharmaceuticals, microplastics and some chemicals.
Yes, so the types of compounds, the chemicals that we're looking at are mainly pharmaceuticals. We're looking at pesticides, especially around the River Ugi, where there's a lot of farming going on. We want to see if any of those pesticides that are maybe being used on the farms are then going into the rivers. We also look at chemicals called endocrine disrupting compounds, which are basically chemicals which can disrupt your hormone function. So that could disrupt human hormone function, or it could disrupt hormone function in wildlife as well.
And when you're thinking of pharmaceuticals, is that stuff like paracetamol, or what is it?
So we look at a lot of different classes of pharmaceuticals. Paracetamol and ibuprofen are two that we do look at. We also look at antibiotics, because antibiotics can actually cause antimicrobial resistance, which means that bacteria can become resistant to antibiotics. We can get that in our bodies if we're taking too many antibiotics, and then our bodies get resistant to it. Also, pharmaceuticals, even at very low levels, studies have shown that they can disrupt reproductive systems in wildlife. So we just want to keep an eye on what's going on in the rivers for these different chemical classes.
So they could be having quite a serious impact.
They could be. We don't know at the moment what is going on, but the main point of our project is try and collect as much data as possible, because there's not much data on Scottish rivers and the chemical levels in Scottish rivers. So the more information we have, we can then pass on to other scientists who could look at wildlife populations, for example, and then try to use our data to fit with their data to see if there's any trends connecting chemical levels, wildlife, maybe decrease in specific wildlife populations.
Have you managed to find anything out so far?
We're standing at the River Ugi now, but in summer last year we finished our year-long sampling of the River Dee, which is also in Aberdeen. And an interesting thing that we found from the River Dee was we actually found paracetamol in the River Dee across different sites and across various months. But in March 2023, we actually saw quite a big spike of paracetamol compared to the levels in the other months. So it made us think, well, did everyone have a cold in March 2023? I don't remember if I had a cold then. But it's kind of ideas and pictures like that that you can start to build with the more data that you have.
How does that end up in our rivers?
So there are different ways which chemicals can enter our rivers. For example, wastewater treatment plants. We, as humans, we will consume paracetamol if we have a cold, or other antibiotics if we have an infection. And not 100% of those chemicals will be processed by our bodies. We naturally go to the toilets. That ends up in our wastewater treatment plants. And some of the more traditional wastewater treatment plants can't actually 100% break down those chemicals, and then they can end up
into our rivers. But also some rivers might have septic tanks from kind of residential housing that could leak into the rivers, which we don't want to happen, but sometimes that can happen. For antibiotics as well, if cattle, for example, on farms are being treated with antibiotics, they're doing their business and then that could be run off into the rivers. And pesticides, like I mentioned before, they're applied on some farms and again they could run off into our rivers. So there's various different sources, which is something we're not focusing so much in our projects. Again, we're trying to gather the data and then it can be explored further later on where the actual sources of the pollution and the contamination is coming from.
So how long will this study take and when do you move on to examining other rivers?
So we're working on the River Yugi just now and we will finish sampling here this summer, so summer 2024. And then the next steps for the project is a nationwide study of rivers all across Scotland, so just not just the northeast. And we want to sample all of these rivers and see what levels we're finding across Scotland. So that'll give us a baseline for different areas, different rivers across Scotland. And from the data, we will then want to propose a list of priority chemicals, which should then be focused on and should be prioritised for monitoring regularly in the future. So we're collecting the data, giving it to the policymakers basically, and then they can decide what they want to do with the data and how they want to act on the data for the future.
It's Dr. Jessica Gomez-Banderas from the James Hutton Institute there.
She didn't mention anything about oestrogen.
I don't recall that.
Okay. So I've read somewhere an article, I think it'll be New Scientist or something like that, that, you know, the detectable levels of oestrogen from contraceptive pills and what mm-hmm. have you in water, which may or may not be affecting breeding success of fish.
Mm. That might have been the class of chemicals she talked about at the start there.
The endocrine.
Interesting how there are these spikes depending on the time of year, like paracetamol in March.
I could understand it in January, but mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, interesting.
And early January at that. Anyway, sheep farming, talking about headaches. Especially at lambing time, it's not really a job, it's a vacation. You've got to love the sheep and love the way of life to stick at it.
Yeah, and that's certainly true. Farmer Cammy Wilson, he is so passionate about what he does that he's got his own YouTube channel called The Sheep Game, which has an absolutely massive following, and it charts the ups and downs of life in the farm.
Cammy is also a presenter on our sister programme, Landward. Now, I went to Ayrshire recently to meet him as he was making preparations for lambing. And one of the things we spoke about is a particularly notorious sheep rescue he was involved in at the back end of last year.
Yeah, that went a bit crazy. So yes, Fiona, the world's loneliest sheep. That all started as, I saw it when it first came in, it was just a local newspaper article, and I messaged the farmer and says, you know, will we come and get this sheep? And he says, no, it's far too dangerous. And then other things happened where other people got involved, and he's like, listen, this has turned into a circus, let's try and get this sheep out of here. And yeah, we got it out, we just thought it was, you know, go down and it'll be a laugh, get the sheep out, you know, we'll manage fine, hopefully. And thankfully we did. Put a little post up on Facebook, and then the world went crazy.
Just explain where it was, this loneliest sheep in the world.
Yeah, so we still don't know how she got there. I mean, the common sense thing is that she probably jumped down looking for a fresh bit of grass, then couldn't get back up. Right. 2 years prior to this event happening.
So she'd been down in this patch of grass for 2 years and it wasn't fresh anymore.
Well, the ironic thing about it, she had so much grass. It was an oasis she was in.
Why'd you take her out then?
That is the big question. Mainly the media. That was why, you know, the SSPCA got a really hard time over it all. Uh-huh. But they were 100% right. They'd went and looked at her from the sea, had a look, saw how much grass she had. She had a cave for shelter. The wool, albeit it was getting overgrown by the time we got her, but when they had been assessing it, the wool was absolutely fine. There's no point risking human life or injury to go and rescue a sheep that's in an oasis. Yeah. And that's why it was left. But they were given a lot of abuse and you know, why haven't you done anything for this poor animal? But she was, I mean, she came out of there 92 kilos. Some of these rams aren't even 92 kilos.
How did you actually get her up?
Yeah, that was a big feed sack. Uh-huh. And a couple of ropes tied together that we picked up from a shop on the way up the road. Yes, a well-known climbing shop on the road up. Tied the two together, put it to a 4x4 buggy at the top and just reversed back very slowly and just guided her up. There was one section maybe of 4 metres that was a kind of vertical climb, but the rest of it I would describe it as crawlable, but like if you slipped you weren't stopping. And in hindsight, you know, the difference between us being labelled as heroes after that and, yeah, and idiots was just a slip of your foot. Do you know what I mean? If somebody had slipped, you'd be saying, why are they fools doing that? They should have waited for the professionals. So we're very lucky.
Strictly speaking, you are the professionals. I mean, no one is expert in retrieving sheep from cliffs.
Well, exactly. We had a good lad, Ali Williamson, there from the Western Isles. I phoned him in specially because the reality is those boys over there on the Western Isles are doing that every day.
All the time.
And never makes the news. So he was going up and doing like a mountain goat. I was holding on for dear life. Thank God we had him.
Yeah. When you got this 92-kilogram Fiona, loneliest sheep in the world, back up the cliff and what have you, did you shear it?
Yes, we did it old school with the hand shears.
Wow.
Because at that point it was November, a bit cold to leave her totally bare, so I got the old hand shears out. Now I'm not exactly proficient in the hand shears, although unbelievably I've been asked to shear for Scotland at the Highland Show for the hand shears, which is terrifying. I'll need to get some practice in, but yeah, that let us leave her maybe with about an inch of cover, so that she would be similar to the other sheep that she was going to join down at she went to Dosgoan Farm at Dumfries. The whole thing, you know, I am very much a traditional farmer, worked with sheep my entire life. But that sheep Fiona was something else. Her whole mannerism, as we were dragging her up in that bag, we've cut a hole for her nose to come through. She was nibbling at the grass.
You're joking. She never stopped eating.
No stress or nothing. You know, you think, not been handled for 2 years, absolute blind panic, as sheep naturally do, they're prey animals, they naturally run and get scared. She's nibbling away at the grass through the bag like it's just a wee jolly. And once we showed her, she sat there the whole time being shown. She stood up. She stood next to her fleece and had a little look. She had a good scratch. It must have felt nice. Yeah. But yeah, her whole manner was, you'd almost thought the thing was set up, like she was a pet lamb and it was staged. It was incredible.
Very, very strange. Why are you so obsessed by sheep? What is it about them that actually catches your attention to the extent it so clearly does?
I suppose one amazing thing about sheep that I really enjoy, apart from the fact I've been born and bred into it and it's almost just bred into me, that almost brainwashed into sheep, is the fact that what we're doing with sheep and the way we're farming sheep has hardly changed in the last 500 years. They still run out in the grass all winter. You know, we're outside here in the fresh air working with them. Some days are nicer than others, granted. But it's such a beautiful, natural process of growing, you know, a fantastic product in Scotch lamb off the grass. None of my lambs get any sort of feed at all. They're just off the grass into the food chain.
Effectively, it's solar-powered protein production. The sun shines, the rain falls, the grass grows, the sheep eat the grass and whatever, it converts it into meat.
Yeah, exactly. You know, apart from maybe fancier lick buckets and a nice mix that we can give to the rams to keep them going, things have hardly really changed.
What's next for you? You're a young man, you know, with a lot of experience behind you, but, you know, what's your ambition?
The ambition for us is to get our own farm in the long run. It's just, it's one of those things, it's expensive, you know. Buying a farm, especially nowadays, interest rates, another factor, it's expensive, so we just need to keep working away with the sheep, wait for the landlord wages to go up, and...
And we'll get, hold
we'll
your breath.
There. No. But we'll get there eventually, hopefully.
Yeah. And would you want to farm in this area, ideally?
Ideally. I mean, who wouldn't want to farm in Ayrshire? You know, just look about us here. It's, as you touched on earlier, it's so green compared to, you know, you guys up towards the east. Like, we're wet, but we're green, and it's a nice place to farm.
Sheep farmer Cammy Wilson there, and you can hear the full conversation with Cammy on the latest edition of Scotland Outdoors on BBC Sounds. We thought it would be a good idea to get Cammy on the phone just now to find out how lambing's actually going live, as it were. Morning, Cammy, how are you doing?
Morning, Mark, yeah, thanks. Good to hear from you.
And you. Oh, I was about to ask if you're in the lambing shed, but I can hear you're in the lambing shed. How's it going?
Not too bad, I tell you. I'm on the hands-free. I'm in the process of milking out a Scotch mule ewe with triplets. She's got a bag on her, like a Holstein cow, though, so they're struggling to get latched on, so I'm just milking her out just now.
How does this year compare to last year? Is it wetter?
Well, I tell you, we had a couple of real bad days at the start last year, which were probably similar to how terrible things were yesterday, but the problem this year has been the rain has never stopped. You know, we've never been able to... we've hardly seen a dry day since Christmas, and it's taken its toll on stock, and I dare say it's definitely taken its toll on farmers, definitely, in terms of mental health.
this kind of weather, Cammy, where it is, you know, it's not, I mean, it's wet more than anything else and potentially windy. You know, we would describe it as lamb-killing weather. I passed a field the other day and there were some new lambs in that and they didn't even have wee coats on or anything. That, you know, what can you do to sort of give them a better chance?
Yeah, well, funny you say that. We've been putting, they're called lamb macks. We've been putting lamb macks on everything that's been bit on the last couple of days. And yesterday, yeah, I mean, we filled a bag and a half of lambs in morning rounds, like, because they've just been born through the night outside, cold and rain. It's just the ultimate combo for killing lambs. Yeah. But I can say we've had a brilliant morning this morning, just because it's so warm. It's 12 degrees, as I say here, and it's that makes all the difference.
Yeah, it's a bit milder. You've also had a bad dog attack this week. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, that was a bit of drama too. We've a lot of problems here, but we're right next to the town, so we do have a lot of problems. But a spaniel got out of control and chased all the in-lamb ewes into a pile in the corner of the field, and then there was maybe four or five that had lambed in that field. It then started targeting them, and my partner, who's quite heavily pregnant, she spent 10 minutes trying to head it off and trying to run after it, but obviously she's not as nimble as she was 30 weeks ago. And it just kept looking by her. And eventually we managed to get it under control, but it was very stressful.
Where was the owner while this dog was running amok?
The problem with this thing, Mark, is it's always virtually every attack we have is decent people that just don't know their dog. And he was ready to collapse. He'd been running that hard trying to get the dog. I give him full credit. He held his hands up to the police. Hmm. He was in floods of tears. He was an absolute shock, the guy, and ready to collapse. Because he, you know, unless you're training or you're doing some sort of exercise, most people are spent after 400 metres flat out. You know, the guy was gubbed. So I wasn't too hard on the guy. You know, it's people just don't understand what these dogs can do.
Yeah, that must have been horrible for you to witness. Has it actually caused any ill effect for the sheep?
Well, touch wood, we've not seen any issues with the pregnant ewes as yet. I don't put many sheep in that field, and I generally put younger, fitter sheep in there because, unfortunately, I have to plan for this happening. So these younger, fitter sheep can take a bit more harassing than some of our older girls. But no, I've not seen anything yet. The only mistake I made was that I was doing the rounds in the dark and I found a lamb in the corner of the field by itself. And I found a ewe shouting for a lamb, so I thought, oh, this must be health. And I come back out in the morning and she'd lambed two fresh lambs, so she now has three. But at least it has a mum.
How many have you still got to lamb?
Oh, about 1,100. We've only got about 100 done.
I'm laughing. Why am I laughing? I don't know.
I know. Do you know what? I'm glad, though, because the forecast moving forward is still wet, but it looks very strangely mild. You know, I mean, everyone's talking about this storm today, but it's to be 15 degrees, I think, over the weekend. It's quite incredible.
And do you do a lot of it indoors, or is it outdoors, or is it a mix?
Basically, everything's outdoors this year, and all we have is a sort of emergency barn that the problems, like this girl that's been milked out and the lambs are being tubed. We bring the problems in and everything else is outdoors.
Cammy, really nice catching up with you, and I appreciate the time you've given us this morning, because you're obviously up to your eyes. Thank you very much again.
Thanks very much to you both. Thank you. Cheers.
Take care. As I mentioned, Cammy is also a presenter on Landward on BBC Scotland, and the new series began this week. So go and have a watch via the BBC iPlayer.
Yeah, and catch up too with the podcast that you did with Cammy, which is very interesting. Yeah. He's got unicorn sheep.
He does have unicorns, and I'd never heard of such a thing. Have a listen to it, Scotland Outdoors, because I just spotted something on this animal's forehead, and I thought, what is that? You know, never heard of it before. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, sitting right next to me at Beechgrove, and sitting, too, because we couldn't have done that first thing this morning because the water was running straight off the roof and onto the seating. But we're sitting now. Beechgrove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yep, one of the best ways is by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds. It means you can do it at your leisure.
At your leisure. Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listened to the podcast. podcast, which is what Mercedes Maurice did. She says, this is just enough to say thank you to everyone on the Out of Doors team for making this delightful podcast.
It's a peaceful morning here when I drink my tea, watch the morning sun dance on Lake Champlain, and listen to your podcast. My last four visits to Scotland still haven't satiated my desire to be there again in both body and spirit, and your podcast helps with the latter. That's from Mercedes Maurice in Vermont in the USA. Time again over the mystery sound. Quite busy on the guesses front. David John Chadwick in Carluke says good morning. The rain is not far away and the wind is getting up, but we look forward to returning to Blair Athol tomorrow and the prospect of sufficient water in the mill lead to power the water mill at the bakery.
Excellent.
I think the mystery sound might be a train in the distance.
No. No. Really, honestly. That one, this is Denise, Phil and Reggie say, good morning from a very soggy Rothes. Plan for the weekend to stay dry. Good luck with that. Denise has looked out her favourite red waterproof jacket ready for our morning walk by the Spey. She's keen. Is today's mystery sound an oyster catcher by the River Spey? See that? It's close. Denise, Phil and a dry Reggie say, dogs don't care if it's raining or not. That's a quote from me earlier. Said, ever had a staffy? And Reggie, the Keep Me Dry Labrador, hates the rain with a passion. We've got a horse from Ireland like that.
Doesn't like
it
the
came
rain.
From Ireland and it can't stand the rain. Honestly. Sue and Lochwinnoth, this is interesting, saying last year I had an invasion of moles in the garden, or possibly one exceptionally busy one, with molehills and tunnels appearing all over the lawns and borders. The wee bism even tunnelled under my greenhouse. After trying all the humane deterrents I could think of to no avail, I was at my wit's end as the garden started to resemble the Somme. I decided to give what I thought was a daft idea, suggested by a fellow gardening enthusiast, a go. Pickled onions.
Oh.
A giant jar was purchased, and said onions were inserted into all the tunnel openings. We were amazed that after a couple of days, the frenetic tunnelling ceased and no new molehills appeared. It worked like a dream, cheap and effective, and humane too.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. I've heard that chilli oil has a similar effect.
Yeah, I'm not sure how humane that would be.
Get in touch if you want to have a guess on the mystery sound, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295, or you can give us a ring on 0885 92 95 00.
As I was driving in this morning, something ran across the road. My first thought was, you know, is it a rat? No. And then I thought, no, it's maybe just a large vole. Tail was much too short for it to be a rat. I mention this because a couple of weeks ago, I visited Hoggenfield Loch in Glasgow, talking about water voles that don't live beside the water anymore. Hoggenfield is part of the Seven Lochs Wetland Park, which is Scotland's largest urban heritage and nature park. And the guy I was talking to about the voles, Scott Ferguson, happens to be project coordinator for the park. So I asked him basically just to show me around.
Here we are at Hoggenfield Loch, which is one of Glasgow's local nature reserves. One of the main attractions here is the swan population. So lots of folk come up and feel a great attachment to the swan population here.
The massive animals, I mean, there's one standing in front of us here, a male, I suspect. You know, but the head is huge. The feet are about the same size as my hands, and I've got big hands.
Yeah, I think they're possibly the second heaviest bird in the UK that can still fly.
Yes.
So, yeah, they're a big, impressive bird. And we also get Icelandic whooper swans here over the winter period. I think they have now headed off on their migration back to Iceland. So they're really only here from September to maybe into March. And they make an amazing journey from Iceland to Hoggenfield. Apparently it's a single flight across the Atlantic from about 12,000 kilometres.
Yeah, that's a huge distance. Yeah. Some achievement. You know, when we arrived here for a start, it was sort of classic Glasgow weather, you know, slightly drizzly and a bit bleh, you know, but the cloud has parted, the sun is out, and just these birds are dazzling. I mean, they're so white.
It's a typical spring day where it goes from that kind of dull to bright sunshine with a flick of a switch, really.
This is the centenary of Hoggenfield Loch, but it wasn't entirely man-made.
No, it's a natural loch. It's an old glacial loch. So it's been here for 10,000 years or more. But the loch was artificially deepened to make it suitable for boating. So that was the main reason why Hoggenfield Park opened in the first instance. There'd been, I think, rowing boats put on another Glasgow pond, and it was such a success that the council was looking for other places to open boating lakes, and Hogganfield was one of those.
We used to come here and walk the girls when they were small, because we lived in Kirkintilloch, and I can remember piling everybody into a rowing boat. You know, they were slightly apprehensive about it, has to be said, but, you know, and rowing across to the island across there. And they then thought it was a huge adventure when we came back and lived. But, you know, the boats are no longer here. Was that always an island?
Absolutely. And the boats are very much part of the folk memory of Hogganfield. And the island wasn't always an island. It was originally a peninsula. So the loch was a kind of U shape. Uh-huh. And then as they were deepening the loch, they created a channel to create an island as a bird sanctuary. So the island was always there as part of the provision for wildlife. And it had a nature trail around it. So up until the 70s, I think school parties would come out and take the boat over to the island and go on the nature trail around it.
No, I mean, it's obviously still clearly very, very popular, and it's not the best of days today, but people are still actually turning out. There's never been any talk about putting boats back on the loch.
We wouldn't ever put them back on permanently. Now that the loch's designated as a local nature reserve, I think the level of disturbance you would get from that would just be too much.
You can see clearly, obviously, you know, gulls and ducks and gassanders and swans and everything else, pigeons along there, moorhens, coots, you name it. There's a lot on the surface of the water. Is there anything underneath it?
I mean, there's a good fish life in the loch, as you can see from the gassanders being here, so they'll feed on the fish.
Rather stupidly, I hadn't put two and two together, but you've got gassanders, you've got fish.
We've got a heronry on the island, so the herons are feeding on amphibians and fish in the loch. And we do allow fishing in part of the loch, and the loch is quite well known as a carp fishery as well. So we have some large carp that you'll very often see fishermen looking for.
Fantastic to have this as a resource, almost bang smack in the centre of a city too, Phil. You know, and you understand why people love it so much.
Yeah, you can see. I mean, we're really only 5 miles maybe from the city centre here, so it's very accessible. I mean, as you said, it's always busy. No matter what time of year, what time of day, there's always going to be somebody taking a walk around the loch. I think there's a certain attraction for people in walking round a loch. I think you see more changes with the seasons. You see different birds. Every time you come, there's something different. So I think that's maybe part of the attraction of walking close to water.
Scott Ferguson there at Hogganfield Loch. And you want to hear something really weird. Recently, because the weather's been so awful, I've been doing stuff inside. And what I've been doing is trying to collate thousands of photographs we have from across the years and whatever. And at random, I picked one of these packets out and I opened it. And there was the photograph of me and my eldest daughter in the rowing boat heading off towards the island on Hogganfield Loch.
Lovely.
I didn't go hunting for it. I did not go hunting for it at all. I have not seen that photograph in years. I just happened to be in that area, so doing some stuff and whatever. And I'd said, we've bundled the entire family in. Mm-hmm. We didn't.
No.
Clearly not. My wife and our youngest child, Beth, at the time, was, forget it. I'm going to stay here. We choose life.
Yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't mind, but I'm actually quite good in a rowboat.
Are you?
Sort of.
Uh-huh, sort of. Obviously,
stayed
not
the right
enough
way
to convince
up.
Your
How
wife.
Much do you want? You know.
I was actually looking at old photographs of this yesterday because you mentioned that it's 100 years old.
Yeah.
And lovely pictures of the Lady Provost at the time looking very sharp, you know, suit and all the rest of it, standing next to the boat.
There is a lovely story about Hogganfield Loch, which I've never entirely been able to pin down, that when they were discussing it, you know, basically doing it up as a civic amenity, one of the councillors, slightly further travelled than others, said, for why do we not get a gondola, you know, and put it on the water for the entertainment of the populace? And his pal says, I agree with Willie there. So, in fact, for why do we not get two and they might breed?
Oh, dear. Now, over the last wee while, we're moving on, thousands of new trees have been planted on the nature reserve at Loch Ardinning near Glasgow, and it's part of a project by the Scottish Wildlife Trust to create a new oak woodland at the site. To stop the grassland choking out these saplings, staff have been laying mulch mats. And recently, to make their job a bit easier, because they've got a lot of work to do, they roped in some helpers who were on a corporate volunteering day.
Yep, We'll take some pegs, take the mat. We've got a split in the mat, just means you can get it round the tree easier. Tuck the tree in, and then it's just a case of one peg in every corner. It's as easy as that.
Okay. So four pegs per mat?
Five pegs per mat. I'm Chris Thompson. I'm the Reserves Project Officer, West Central, for Scottish Wildlife Trust.
So explain what the volunteers are doing today and why they're needing to do that.
The volunteers are putting mulch mats around trees which were planted between 1 and 2 years ago. The reason we're doing that is the trees were planted on former grazing land. The grass layer is smothering the trees. The water is transpiring out. The topsoil is actually relatively thin here, so the trees were suffering drought stress and being smothered. So by putting a mulch mat around it, we'll give the trees a bit of a fighting chance to get above the grass layer and establish themselves.
And the mulch mats are quite straightforward in terms of laying them on the ground.
Yeah, it's dead simple. It's just hard, monotonous work, I'm afraid. It's a very satisfying work once you've been through it and look back and think, we've done a couple of hundred mats today and you can see them all laid out. And now I know some of the regular volunteers, when they come up the road, they look, you can see the mats from the road and think, oh, we did all that. So they get a certain amount of satisfaction. And coming into spring now, hopefully we're seeing a lot more trees coming into leaf. They're not going to be covered by the grass, so it will start to sort of look like a woodland at some point, and especially in the next 3 to 5 years. But it'll be 20 years before there is a woodland here.
Tell me a little bit about this site, because as you say, there is some woodland here already, but you're trying to establish some more.
You'll see where these pine trees are on your right-hand side. That was a larch woodland, but because of Phytophthora remora and also because it's a non-native species, we made the decision to remove that woodland. Part of removing the woodland means you have to do a restocking to a density of 1,600 stems a hectare.
And you've planted a mix of trees here.
Yes, there's a mix of trees here. So we're trying to create an oak woodland. So we've got sessile oak is our main species that's gone in here. Downy birch, hazel, bird cherry, hawthorn, blackthorn, holly, dog rose, and aspen as well. So
all native.
All native species, yes.
There we go. Right, bed it in. So I'm Lee Pounder, I'm the regional director for SPL Power Lines.
You've made light work of this.
I'm going to say I've done this before, but I haven't. Quite therapeutic. After having stressful days in the office, it's very, very good, actually.
So tell me what's brought you here today, then, how you've got involved with this.
So we're a railway contractor and we've got an initiative where you identify a hazard on site, we will come and plant a tree for you raising that hazard. So it's a sort of a reward system for our employees. It also helps when we are a decarbonisation contractor. We do a lot with carbon net zero, so this is about giving something back as well.
You'll do a surprising number.
Right.
Tell me your name.
Cassandra.
Have you done anything like this before?
Never. I mean, I've been out in the rainy Scottish weather before, been out camping and things like that, but I've never actively done any wildlife, you know, habitat conservation, so this is great. I feel like I'm doing something useful.
Yeah, so you're getting a sense of satisfaction from it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the weather is typically Scottish, but it doesn't really matter, and considering what we're doing in terms of sort of, you know, providing water for these trees is perfect. We're getting the rain, we're putting the mulch mat down, and it's keeping it all in. So, yeah.
There we go. That's quite satisfying, actually, once you get it through. And I'm Lewis. It's actually fairly easy. Chris did a pretty good demonstration. I feel like I'm getting practice in for summer camping with trying to poke the tent pegs into firmer ground than it looks.
Yeah, so you've not done anything like this before?
No, not at all.
And are you normally someone who's based in an office?
Yeah, like I'm a project manager, so it's an office-based job, but we get out on site quite a lot. And that's kind of a good thing about being on the railway. You get a bit of a variety, day shift, night shift, on track. But Aye, I'd say mostly in the office.
So is it quite nice being up on the top of a hill, even on a wet day?
Yeah, it's great. This is the thing, because I'd otherwise be sitting in the office today, although drier and warmer. But it's nice that it's just to come out and kind of... We're kind of working by ourselves at the moment, so you kind of get a bit of silent me time out in the open, which is nice. I was saying to Chris, like, I live not far from here, but I've never actually come up, driven by the car park so many times over the years, but never wandered up this side of the road. So definitely be back up for a wander.
Number three, come round here for these two.
And how long will the mulch mats be down for, and what happens to them?
The mulch mats are biodegradable, so they will just disappear into the soil. We're expecting a 3-year life expectancy, but at the moment, with it being so wet and just looking at some of the mats we put down at the beginning of winter, I think we're looking maybe 2 years. But I think that should be enough to get the trees above the grass layer and get them established. So it's going to be an ongoing monitoring thing. So it might be I come round with a brush cutter and brush cut thick grass in the future, but I'm hoping not.
That's Chris Thompson from the Scottish Wildlife Trust and his corporate volunteers from SPL Powerlines, Lee, Cassandra and Lewis. They did really well because it was absolutely bucketing rain.
I did laugh when the guy said, if we have a problem, if somebody reports a problem to us, we go there and plant a tree. I thought, how's that going to help? Anyway, staying with oak trees now, earlier in the week I visited Drumcastle-near-Bankery, where the National Trust has been working at looking after the long-term sustainability of the old wood of Drum. Bronwyn Thomas, a ranger with the National Trust of Scotland, showed me how.
So this is the new Drum tree nursery. So it was set up in beginning of November. So in here we've got the oaks.
I was about to say, I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings for a moment, Bronwyn, but I can't see any trees.
No, I know. They're covered up with this carrot netting.
Aye.
So it's a way of keeping the mice out. We did have a little bit of an incident, okay. But now they're all fine, so...
So basically you're taking off a couple of covers, which is covered in netting, nylon netting.
And then I've got them doubly protected at the moment, because I definitely don't want anything happening to
you
them.
You don't want to get the mice getting cold. Yeah.
Here they are.
Okay. So, I still can't see anything.
No, there's not a lot visibly happening at the moment.
Ah.
But they are growing. I have had a little look, and they are growing.
Okay. So you've basically taken acorns from what and planted them here?
So from oak trees in the old wood of Drum. So they were collected during something called the Oak Witch Scramble, which was run by the Ranger Service. So it happened just before I arrived. I arrived in October. It happened at the beginning of the month. And they basically got lots of school children from the local area to help them collect loads of acorns. And then we've planted them. Yeah. So that's what these are.
So you've just got little 3-inch pots and what have you. And how far back do the Oak Woods of Drum date?
A very long way. So The old wood of Drum was first mentioned in 1247, but it's probably been continuous woodland cover for a lot longer than that as well. So it was originally a hunting forest, a royal hunting forest, and it was given to William de Irwin by Robert the Bruce. The oldest oaks that we have are about 300 years old, 250 to 300 years old, but there's been trees on the site for hundreds and hundreds of years.
We're not tremendously far away from Aberdeen, which is a long and distinguished history of shipbuilding and things like that. Presumably those oak trees would have been pretty valuable once upon a time.
Definitely, yeah. So the old wood really was an economic resource for the Irwin family. So they lived here for just over 600 years, and it definitely, you know, helped them to build their wealth and maintain the wealth. So the wood's been managed primarily for an economic resource for all of that time. So the Bon Accord, for example, that was a ship that was definitely built from Drum Oak, but it would have been sold, you know, to lots of different places for building materials, ships and buildings too.
Do people still sort of rock up and say, you know, I'm looking to repair such and such a ship, you know, you got any good oak?
They've not asked me. I'm not sure.
They're going to be disappointed if they see this lot.
They are, yeah.
You're not going to do much with that, isn't it?
No, we don't. The wood isn't managed like that now. It became a triple SI in 1983. So basically the work of the NTS is to try and preserve the wood and to keep the trees in the wood doing what they do best, providing home for wildlife. So it's not sold any wood that falls down is pretty much left in the old wood.
I can't remember how many species are actually associated with a, you know, with a mature oak tree, but it's in the hundreds.
Well, I think it might be thousands, actually.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I think the number I have anyway is about 2,300 are associated with oak trees, and then a couple of hundred depend just on oak trees for survival. Yeah, so it's amazing the homes that they can offer.
And if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
25.
Oh, well, you're laughing then. You'll see something halfway decent by the end of your career.
Hopefully.
Rowan Thomas, a ranger with the National Trust for Scotland at Drumcastle there.
Mm, very nice, yeah. Mystery sound again. We've got lots of answers coming in now.
Indeed.
Will we tell you some of the wrong ones?
Go on.
David in Inverkip says, is it a grey wagtail? Craig in Bear's Den, is the mystery sound a kingfisher singing in the tree?
Kenny Dunfermline thought it might be an early duckling near the falls of Dochart at Killin. That's very specific, Kenny. Well done to that. Dennis Forbes Grattan thought it might be a sandpiper, but says the highest rainfall in Scotland has to be Ullapool, as it's always lashing rain when I'm there.
Mr. Donald, very formal that, says it's a robin. Bert from Stonehaven, whenever I see a dipper in the local river, more often than not, there is a wagtail nearby, so my guess is a yellow wagtail.
And David Petrie says, good morning, today's sound, I think it was a petrie. I think it's a high-speed train rushing through a railway cutting. My dad from Brechin used to be a gamekeeper, always called peewits, chuchits, definitely not curlews. Curlews being upland moorland birds and more solitary than lowland peewits. Dry here in Yetham, he says.
Not got long to get your guesses in, so get in touch.
Queen Margaret University in Musselburgh is just and it was a funny noise. I wasn't sure where I was going with that. Queen Margaret University in Musselburgh has just recently opened its outdoor learning hub in Discovery Trail. It's a great resource for student teachers, but interestingly, it's open to the entire community. Patrick Boxall is a lecturer in education at QMU, and he very kindly showed me around.
So here we are standing in University Square at Queen Margaret University, next to the map of the outdoor learning hub Discovery Trail. And this map shows us around the campus through multiple different habitats that are just like habitats that we all live near. Hedges, wee tiny woods, little bit of water over there. And on this map, we're also connecting to our digital world. So through the QR code just here, you can connect to video content that explains about the habitat, but it's also invitational. It says, come and think about what are the gifts of these places for us as human beings to connect to think about for activity. What can we do there? How can we be there and just, you know, find some kind of meaning and being in the natural world? And also, how can we learn?
We've picked a perfect day for this because classically, it is peeing rain. You know, if it comes on hard again, you'll hear it on the umbrella above our heads at the moment because it was pretty torrential a second ago. People worry about that, thinking, oh, you know, we're taking small children out in bad weather. The kids could not care less.
Absolutely. And in Scotland, you know, we've got a really strong movement with the early years of just getting the wee ones outside, and you see them bundled up in their salopettes and their raincoats and their wellies. And actually, a wet weather day is a fun day.
Yeah. I take exactly what you say about the fact of, you know, using the environments within the campus of the university itself, because again, there's this daft idea that nature is over there somewhere. We are somewhere different. But the fact is, nature is absolutely everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, what we've got here is an incredible semi-urban habitat with lots of green space, some of which is manicured, like these terraces we're about to walk through. But nevertheless, those manicured spaces are fantastic for insects and for different kinds of flowers that are the foundations of an ecosystem.
What have you had to put in here to make it an outdoor learning centre?
So, first of all, we thought about it as a whole thing. So we had to mark the trail. Now, there's paths already here. Uh-huh. It was about using what we got and just showing that these are places that we can engage with the natural world, that maybe would walk, the kind of place that you'd walk past and perhaps on your way to work and you wouldn't think twice about.
Yeah, quite.
And then what we've also done is started to identify particular spaces that are really exciting. So we're walking down through an area that will be a meadow in a few months' time, hopefully, as we continue to replant the grass with meadow flowers. And we've created down here what we call the Howth. And the Howth is a shelter right in the centre of our campus area that's actually set inside a new forest, actually called a wee forest, that's part of a project that goes on across Scotland and is connected to a project that goes on across the world called the Tiny Forests. And that's about planting 680 trees. So we put in the trees, supported by Nature Scot. We put in the trail and the house, supported by Architecture and Design Scotland. And that's creating this focus for learning and activity.
It looks like a Stone Age hut. Circular, it seems to have a clear perspex dome on the roof, but the majority of the roof is covered in turf. It's a nice design.
Absolutely. So what we've got here is a traditional build. It's constructed using various traditional crafts. When we go inside, you'll see a reciprocal roof, which is self-supporting, absolutely incredible. The dome brings light in this beautiful way. The turf that you can see is actually wildflower matting. That has only gone in a few months ago, but hopefully by the end of the growing season, we will see it being a multicoloured. It'll have a multicoloured rug rather than just a green helmet. You know, it'll be fantastic.
It's nice to have this here, but really, what are the benefits of outdoor learning?
The benefits of outdoor learning are so varied. There's a massive one about connecting us to nature. We need to connect to the natural world, particularly at this time in our history. But also, it can really help young people and people of all ages to do well, to achieve. There's lots and lots of evidence now that learning outdoors can help people succeed more effectively. And the other big one is it's fantastic for our health and well-being.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just look up. Here we are in the house.
The last time I saw a roof like that was actually on a yurt, but this is an industrial scale. I mean, these are big, big tree trunks that have been used, and you can smell the sort of fresh timber off it. It's lovely.
Absolutely. So all of this wood came from East Lothian, so our tree miles are about 30. The most high-tech thing that's gone into constructing this is a chainsaw. Everything else has been traditional tools and hand. You know, we put this roof up together, you know, about eight people per beam.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. And the whole idea is that the last beam goes over the previous one, but under the first one, and then the whole thing lowers down, and you hear this wonderful creak.
Creak, just as it sounds.
And it settles. And that's it. And then you just pin it in, but it's self-supporting.
This is a teacher training university. So these facilities, you know, this encouragement towards outdoor learning, is that going to be aimed exclusively at sort of a new intake, at new teachers, or will existing teachers get a chance to sort of learn from this too?
Oh, it's both. And it's teachers and educators of all types. We've got courses at this university that are about education in a broader sense that may lead to work in the community or early years or adult ed. But, of course, teachers as well. We've got a big primary cohort. So it's about trying to embed outdoor learning into educators' practice.
One last question from me. I know we're standing in a building that's got wooden beams and a wooden roof, and it's clad in wood, and it's surrounded by wood. Where's your fire pit, Patrick? Come on, where is your fire pit?
We thought hard and long about this. So we may have fires occasionally, but we wanted this space here to be multi-use. Because once you put a fire pit in, that's what it's used for. So this space can be used for performance, for drama. I'm hoping that the community come in and run sessions with scouts and guides and yoga. And so around this space, I'm seeing multiple activities. And also, it's really key. It's not just for outdoorsy folk like me standing here, you know, in well comfortable shoes. It's for everyone. So I want to see sport and I want to see food, music and enjoyment, because it's accessible. Look, the path around here, anyone can get in. It's been designed so that someone in a wheelchair or with a buggy can get into the house, but also can reach out and interact with the woodland around as it grows up. Because you can see the trees, they're totty at the moment. But in a few years' time, we'll actually be in a house in a wood, and that'll be very exciting.
Patrick Boxall, the lecturer at Queen Margaret University, talking about the new outdoor learning hub.
Yeah, very interesting. Time now to reveal our mystery sound for this week. Let's have a final listen.
Have you got any more wrong ones?
No.
I've got right ones.
Go on then.
This week's Smarty Pants Awards go to Andrew Barry, Roman Camp, Broxburn, who says it's an otter. Sean says, I think it's an otter. Cheers. Davey G says, is the mystery sound an otter? Possibly an otter pup or kit. That's exactly right. Interesting feature on badgers, and good to hear Eddie Palmer, the Scottish Badger, speaking about them with respect. They are fascinating animals, which are sadly mostly seen dead on or beside the road. I'll check out the Scottish Badger's website and hopefully find somewhere where I can observe them live. And adds, Jim Crumley has written a book about badgers.
Donald, is that what we're up to? Donald says, a young otter. Francis in Orkney, same, young otter. Says it's a superb programme. Thank you. Malcolm from Bridge of Allen, Otter Cub calling for its mother, and Rona and Lorna also getting it right. Very good.
Yeah, well, Lorna had a re-guess. She too goes.
Did she?
Which is a bit of a sweat, really.
The sound actually came from Dr. Alan Knox. He said, would this be of any interest to you when he got in touch? He recorded it chirping at the Shack and Briggian cults at lunchtime yesterday. Definitely of interest. Thank you very much. If you want to send a mystery sound to us, please go ahead. It makes our life so much easier.
I can't, you know, just something has just crossed my mind. I was coming back from Drum Castle the other day, you know, and there's that bridge just as you go into Peter Cooter. On the left-hand side, there is there's a statue perched on the rock of a Highlander. It's a painted statue. Is it Rob Roy? Possibly Rob Roy McGregor? Don't know.
Don't know. I'm struggling
to picture behind that?
Don't know. We'll send you out and you can find out.
Me and my big mouth.
Quick comment here from Nameless. Listening with a cup of chai in the sunroom at Balruddery.
Posh main listener.
Can't see Dundee for grey rain clouds. And certainly don't feel like I live in Scotland's driest place this year. The dog walk's been put off as they're still damp from last night. Give my regards to Cammy. His positivity in the face of what his family had to go through with the most recent dog attack is inspiring.
And David from Annisland says, the Huggy. Hogganfield Loch was home to the Glasgow School Sailing Club, which I attended in the 60s. Spring evenings after school, we were all terrified of a legendary pike, so capsize drill was quite a test. I bet you they did it quick, though. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. I don't know if we've got a Scotland Outdoors podcast midweek. I don't think we do, not on Wednesday. Anyway, don't forget the one about today. It'll be available today at noon. Meanwhile, from all the team here, you'll be delighted to hear that the rain has stopped and it's actually quite mild so far and the wind's not up. Thanks for listening.